The course that I've been asked to teach this term at Christ College is a continuation of one that I began last year, the history of Western philosophy. Last year I taught the history of ancient and medieval philosophy, and this term we'll be looking at the history of Renaissance and modern philosophy. Now, one disadvantage that we're at right now is that the vast majority of you in the class today have not had the ancient and medieval course. So I hope that you might get the tapes for that course and sit it, that is, do the assignments and listen to the tapes and so forth, and fill in that gap. But since you can't do that in the next few seconds, I have to teach you Renaissance philosophy, and there's nothing there. So one of the first things we'll do, as your lecture outline indicates, is go through a recapitulation and review of ancient and medieval philosophy so that I can get into Renaissance philosophy. Renaissance philosophy is difficult to date. When we get to introducing it, I will give you a whole plethora of dates and events and individuals to show you how there's so much crisscross and cross-fertilization, really, of different movements and themes and individuals, that it's pretty difficult to put a specific date on the beginning of the Reformation or the Renaissance or the Scientific Revolution or any of these things. You have to remember that as we study history, we try to put it into some kind of coherent order. We try to bring meaning to the mass of particulars that are there. And sometimes elementary introductions to history may give the idea that, you know, one day everyone got up and they said, oh, the Renaissance starts today. You know, it's kind of like, well, summer vacation starts today. Today, the Renaissance began. It didn't happen that way. The Renaissance came into existence, if you will, over 150, 200 years. It is true that at a particular point, you might be able to look and say people self-consciously think of themselves as Renaissance people. But they didn't just decide to do that. The city council, you know, didn't declare, you know, Duke Snyder Day and, oh, and by the way, this is Renaissance Day. We're going to begin. So that's why you get fluid accounts. Not everyone will date it the way Dr. Bonson does, although I think it's fairly common to do what I'm doing. It's not altogether, you know, unique to me, but you'll see different beginning points for the beginning of the Renaissance, different end points for the Middle Ages. When I taught the ancient and medieval course, I suggested the year 1450 as a round date for the end of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the Renaissance. You'll see in your outline I've backed that up 50 years just for the sake of rounding it off and stressing that there's overlap between the end of the Middle Ages, beginning of the Renaissance. But 1450 is a good date because you have two significant events most people think would tie into the end of the Middle Ages and the beginning of the Renaissance. We have the fall of Constantinople to the Turks in 1453. And the year right before that, Leonardo da Vinci was born, who was the ultimate Renaissance man. So about 1450 is a good day to look at, or date to look at, for the ending of the Middle Ages. But for our purposes in the outline, I back that up a few more years to 1400. And having done that, and to prove my point, when we get to the lecture, you'll see I'll actually be saying the Renaissance begins in the 1300s in various ways. The seeds of the Renaissance are there, but we'll get to it. Let's back up and talk about the history of philosophy, see if we can recapitulate everything that took me 2 weeks to do in less than an hour here. I'm not sure if I'm capable of doing that. But in our original course, the first thing that I did is I introduced philosophy and the history of philosophy to our students, and part of that introduction brought us to what the enduring questions are. Why do people do philosophy? What is it they're doing when they do it? What are the questions that they ask? The reason why your Renaissance outline begins with Roman numeral 17 is because it's a continuation from the first course, which ended with Roman numeral 16. But let me go through that outline for the first course with you, just so you have some idea of what we talked about. And then again, I encourage you all to go back and get the details and study all of the material in that course if you didn't have it last year. This is a history of Western philosophy. And I want to stress all three of those words. First, it's a historical course. This is not a systematic, topical, or thematic course. We're looking at the development through history of philosophy and philosophical speculation rather than looking at the primary questions of philosophy. Looking at the questions or the themes or the systematic issues is, in a sense, my preference as a teacher. Maybe it's more akin to my personality, but I like to go, when we study the history of philosophy, it's for the sake of learning what the issues are and how people answered them and so forth. But nevertheless, you need to realize that we're not going to have the convenience of, you know, raising the question, is man matter or is man mind or is man both, and what's the relationship to them, and then looking at all the different answers and finally saying, okay, boom, this is it. That would be the systematic or topical way of studying philosophy. We're going to be looking at a number of thinkers throughout history, most of whom had an opinion one way or another on whether man is matter or mind or a combination of the two. So it's a history course, and it's a history of Western philosophy. Okay, I am not, in our day and age, intimidated by the Eurocentric critique. You may be aware that most major universities have come under the polemical barrage of the multiculturalists who believe that it's wrong for us to study, for instance, the history of something Western, because that suggests that Eurocentric, European, American, British history is more important, say, than African or Asian or what have you. And this is not a matter of racial superiority or ethnic superiority or cultural elitism or anything. It's simply a recognition that where we are is the development of Western history. It's not primarily the development of Asian or African or other kinds of history. They are worthy of study in themselves. I believe that you will draw some value distinctions if you compare Western history to Asian history or African history, and you'll understand why, in terms of the advances in socio-political theory, in scientific theory, in philosophical theory that raise modern questions today, those things are tied primarily to Western history and not the others. But I just want to make that clear. I'm not pretending to give you a history of the world and all its thought. This is Western history. That means we begin with the Bible, and we go through the Greeks and the Romans, and then European history and on. It's a history, I said that, it's a history of Western philosophy. I wish we could talk about all the political movements, all the artistic accomplishments, all the literature throughout this, but then it would be a much longer course and it wouldn't be given even the minimal focus that it has when we say we're going to try to boil it down to looking at the history of philosophical thought. What is philosophy? Philosophy does not study one of the areas of human experience isolated or abstracted from the others. And the way that a biologist studies life or a botanist studies plants, or a psychologist studies human feelings and conduct, philosophy is not another one of the areas of life that we can isolate in that way. Philosophy is the study of the underlying assumptions and presuppositions of all fields of inquiry, as well as an attempt to unify the results of what the historians and the physicists and the biologists and psychologists and all the rest give us, trying to synthesize or unite all of their findings into a coherent worldview, a general picture of life where every aspect of man's experience has its proper place. So philosophy asks about the presuppositions of every field of inquiry, as well as how you will bring all the results of the various fields of inquiry into a coherent worldview. Okay, so that's what this overarching three courses is about. The history, that is the evolutionary development, the outworking of different ideas in Western thought, the history of Western philosophy. When did philosophy begin? You will uniformly in the textbooks be told that philosophy began with the Greek Thales, the Milesian cosmologist Thales. I argued last term that philosophy began in the Garden of Eden, that in fact all men do philosophy. It's just a question of how you do it, or how well you do it, or how self-consciously you do it. Adam and Eve were philosophers, their children were philosophers, and all their children's children were philosophers. And everyone who's ever lived is a philosopher. Everyone who's alive today is a philosopher. Because everyone has got to answer these basic questions. What do I think is real? How do I know what I know? And how should I live my life? So everyone does philosophy, but it'll be obvious to you that not everyone does it well. Your next-door neighbor doesn't know any philosophical vocabulary, is not interested in academic matters at all. In fact, if you ask him, you know, what are you living for, he says, hey, you go around once in life, grab for all the gusto you can get. It doesn't sound sophisticated, it doesn't sound like he's philosophical, but there is a philosophy embedded in what he has said. You only live once, okay, so he believes man is matter, there's no life after death. You're to grab for all the gusto you can get. So he's a hedonist. He thinks pleasure is the highest value. That directs his conduct. So he's got an ethic. He's got a metaphysic. He also has an epistemology, a theory of knowledge. How do you know that that is true? Hey, that's what I heard from everybody else, you know. Whatever it may be, that is a philosophy. It's not a good one. It's easy to refute. It may be silly. It may be venial in many ways, but it is a philosophy. Everyone does philosophy. So when did philosophy begin, if everyone does philosophy? Well, it began when man began, and that means we have to trace the history of philosophy back to the Garden of Eden. I raised some questions about the meaning of history, because if you stop and think about it, only Christians, or in some heretical version of Christianity, Marxism is a heretical version of Christianity when it comes to this question, only in Christianity do you have the concept of history having meaning, that history has an origin, that it's going somewhere, that it's controlled by some purpose. So when we talk about the meaning of history, we're talking about the biblical worldview, and then of course the secularizations and offshoots and heresies that are built on the biblical worldview. Where is meaning found? If we just take the mass of particulars in history, there's no meaning. I mean, when someone writes a history book, you notice not everything, this is the period Hobbes to Hume, this particular book, not everything that could be said is in this book. You know, we don't list all the children of every individual that ever lived, or how much rice they ate while they were alive, or how much it cost them to buy that rice, and on and on and on and on. That's because you have to select when you write history. You have to select the things to be mentioned. And what is the principle of your selection? Why do you mention some things, leave other things out? Well, you choose those things that you think are relevant to what? The meaning of history. Those things which are most important. Those things which explain why other events took place. So you have some concept of the meaning of history. But in a random universe, in a universe where everything happens by chance, that is to say, in a universe outside of that taught by the Bible, where there's no sense of providence, a sovereign God who controls and directs every event according to his counsel, and therefore everything, every detail has a place in God's plan. Outside of that concept, when you write history, I mean, it's just a crapshoot. It's who knows what it's all about? Who knows what's the most important, you know, stuff to pick out? And when one person picks out this line of facts, you know, another person can pick out another one and say, no, I think this is the thread of history. No, I think this is the thread of history. And what that tells you is that everybody is actually imposing their own meaning on history. One person's mind says, well, I think politics is the most important. Or Marx thought that, you know, means of exchange and economics is the most important. Somebody else might think that religious devotion is the most important factor in history. Or military might, or whatever it might be. You know, everybody has their own idea, and they project it backwards on history so that they can draw a line through all those details as though they could write a book on history and make sense out of that, excluding some things, including other things. But if meaning is imposed on history, then history books turn out to be autobiographical, don't they? To be very blunt about it, there's a, you know, a nicer way of saying it, but when all is said and done, history books are just the author's way of looking at things. The whole concept of objective truth in history is a Christian concept. And the reason I push to that, and I need to move on and just do a summary right now, but the reason I push that in the last term is because I want you to appreciate that college education, the study subject, and now I'm looking at my particular subject, the history of philosophy, is impossible outside the Christian worldview. Other people who study the history of philosophy will either disdain Christianity, ignore it, totally repudiate it, but without the Christian worldview, there would be no history of philosophy to study. There'd just be autobiographical impositions of meaning projected backwards by one writer and another on the massive details that are out there. Obviously, there are two different ways of doing philosophy, depending upon how one is related to God. Those who are in rebellion against God are not going to do philosophy. They're not going to try to answer the questions about the nature of reality and how we know what we know and how we should live our lives by submitting to God. They either repudiate God or they believe that God's too far removed from human experience to be relevant or to be authoritative or to be even interested in what they are doing, or they have distorted views of God. They have their idols of their own imagination, whatever. So non-Christians are going to answer philosophical questions and approach philosophical questions differently than Christians. And so throughout the history of philosophy, just like throughout the history of culture, you will find that there's a basic interaction or antithetical relationship being seen over and over and over again as the thought of God's people, you know, be it sophisticated and mature and sanctified, or just, you know, basically very immature and you know, mixed up. But the thought of God's people and the kind of worldview that Christians, those who are submitting to God's revelation, set forth, the kind of culture they develop and so forth, is always up against what worldly thinking is saying. Okay? Unbelievers approach philosophical questions differently than believers. I've already given you a grand illustration of that and the fact that just about every history book on philosophy begins with Thales. Why is that? Well, because most of these people, in the first place, don't even believe in the Bible. or the accuracy of its history, much less the truth of the creation account. And so why would they begin with Adam and Eve like Dr. Bahnsen did? Well, they have a different view of man, a different view of God, a different view of history, a different view of how we know what we know, and a different view of how we should live our lives. And they don't believe they have to submit their thinking to God's thinking. So they don't begin their history books with Adam and Eve. But when I teach history of philosophy, I do. Why is the difference? Well, I'm trying to. I'm not always real good at it, but I'm trying to be faithful as a Christian doing my philosophy. But my attempt to do philosophy in that way, you see, is going to set me over against somebody who ignores the Bible or ignores God's Word. History of philosophy, from beginning to end, is going to be characterized by that. The thought of the world and the thought of God's people clashing. So one of the major questions we have to ask is, how do we deal with that antithesis? You know, what can Christians learn anything from the world? Should we pay attention to what the world is saying? How should we pay attention? What are the major questions that people ask in philosophy? In the course on ancient philosophy, I suggested that there are four basic kinds of issues or questions, and then I will apply those four by asking four specific questions, let me explain this to you. Philosophy is motivated by the desire to find explanations. How do things happen? Why do things happen? And to justify those explanations by means of certain standards or methods, with a view to resolving internal conflicts in the various kinds of explanations that you have. Let me say that again. Philosophy is motivated by the desire to find explanations, to justify those explanations, and to resolve internal conflicts in your pattern of explanations. Okay, let's go back at the beginning of history, the history of thought, history of philosophy, and just see if I can illustrate this. I see things happening in the world about me, and I want to understand the world better. I not only want to know what happens, I want to know why it happens. Now, one of the kinds of things that I see, that things fall. Okay, I've got a book here. Notice that? It fell. And if I were to take my glass, it would fall. And anything else, any physical object in the room, we notice when you let it go, it drops. Maybe not very interesting, but that's one of the things that happens in this world. Now, what else happens in this world? Well, I've noticed from time to time that young men ask young ladies out on a date. That's another one of the events in this world. Now, we could talk about all kinds of others. Let's just focus on two things. Books falling, boys asking girls out on a date. Now, I want to understand why these things happen. Why do books fall when you let them drop, when you let them go? Well, eventually, if you get sophisticated, you have an explanation that says there's a law of gravity or there's gravitational attraction between the mass of the earth and the mass of the book and so forth, so that it is going to go toward the earth if you let it go. Now, it's not as though the earth has a desire to date the book and says, please come here, I'd like to cuddle with you. Isn't that right? It's not volitional. It's not a matter of, you know, well, sometimes it falls, sometimes it doesn't. There's this mechanical, universal, predictable thing that happens because of what we call the law of gravity. Is that true of dating relations? Mechanical, predictable? No, I mean, that's the fun as well as the torture of dating. It's unpredictable. You don't know whether she'll say yes, whether she'll say no. You don't know whether the right guy is going to ask you out. You don't know if you want to go out with this guy. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't, you know? Sometimes you go out and you decide, I don't want to go out with this guy anymore. Now, what explains that? Well, certainly not the law of gravity. So, if philosophy is a desire to find explanations, to justify those explanations, and resolve internal conflicts, you see, already we've got a conflict because I thought I explained events by the law of gravity, to be simplistic. But now I've come up against something where I don't explain it by the law of gravity. Dating relationships have psychological, emotional, and other kinds of explanations. But psychology is not like the law of gravity. So, is this a mechanical world, a predictable world, or is it an unpredictable world? Is it volitional, or is it non-volitional? Philosophers have always been mystified, troubled by those sorts of things, and they try to resolve them. The second thing philosophy has done, and we see this with the ancient Greeks, is it's attempted to understand nature, matter in motion. What is nature? What is this stuff out here? What's the world made of? How is change possible? What is it that allows for change? How does it come about that you were located in a bed somewhere in Greenville this morning and now you're sitting here at a desk? How did those changes take place? How do tadpoles become frogs? Why do young people become old and die? How is change possible? Now, when we look at the world and the stuff that makes it up and notice that it changes, does anything get preserved through the process of change? Is there an identity in this stuff that changes? Let me be personal with you. You know, all of you probably have mothers that have scrapbooks that show pictures of you when you were babies and when you went to kindergarten, when you graduated from high school, and all that kind of nostalgic stuff, right? And the day will come when you'll be middle-aged and overweight and so forth, and then if you live long enough, you'll be old and infirmed and all the rest. Now, if we put all those pictures together, quite clearly there's been a lot of change. But are you the same person through all those changes? Is there a personal identity there? Now, you all know that the answer that would commonly be given is yes. But, you know, trying to explain how there is something that's the same through all these changes is very difficult. Likewise, when, we see just molecular changes because of the decay process, say, in an apple. Is there anything, if the apple is constantly changing because of the molecules and the breakdown and finally the putrefaction process and so forth, is there anything that's the same through all of that? Philosophers want to know, is there identity through change? And what is the relationship between the underlying stuff of which things are made and the changing appearances? So that's the second major question or a major issue in philosophy, how to understand nature, matter in motion. A third major question is reason an instrument for obtaining objective knowledge of reality? Should we trust the reasoning process as an instrument for gaining a knowledge of reality? A knowledge which is objective or public, not just personal opinion or subjective. And how should we use this reason? One approach says, stop and reflect on things. Look for internal order and coherence in your explanations. Another says, don't worry about what things must be like in terms of your thinking process. Go look and see what the world is like. So you have a rationalist approach and an empiricist approach to the use of reason as an instrument in gaining knowledge. Not everybody has said you should trust reason, but those who say you should don't agree on how you should use it. So there's a third major issue in the history of philosophy. Fourthly, by what kind of values should man live? And are these values objective? For instance, if you're a naturalist, if you believe that everything in this world is explained by natural processes, not by man being a spirit or being a free creation of God or by God or by angels or spirits or anything else, if there's nothing but the natural world, then are ethical values objective? How can there be values which are immaterial in a completely naturalistic and material world? is man morally distinct from the animals? Is man unique? Or is man just one more animal that somehow got it into its head to think morally? And should reason control our passions? Or should we let pleasure have free rein in our lives? What's the place of honor or justice or integrity? Does moderation or peace of mind or any of these things make any difference? Should we live for them? Should we die for them? Questions of that sort about values have, you know, captured the thought of philosophers. And so let me recapitulate for you. Four major questions, four major issues in the history of philosophy. The desire to find explanations that are justified and don't have internal conflicts. That's probably the biggest issue in the history of philosophy. Find a worldview that it can account for everything without contradicting itself, and that is not arbitrary. To understand nature, to understand reasoning, nature is two, reasoning is three, and to understand value, four. These are the key driving issues for philosophers. So looking over that again, I'm going to give you four specific questions you can go home and chew on. Anytime you have a lot of extra time and you want to say, I'm going to work on my philosophy, my philosophical skills. Isn't that what you do in your free time? You say, hey, here's some time. Some people work on ping pong, some people, you know, weed the garden and so forth. But college students, they finally get into their head that, hey, I could spend some of my time becoming a philosopher. When you want to ask philosophical type questions, here are some that you can ask. Is man's mind self-sufficient? Is man's mind self-sufficient? Or, it's another one to chew on, is there an objective moral order? Is there an objective moral order? Is there public truth that is accessible by reason? Is there a truth about anything that is objective, that is public and accessible by man's reasoning? And then finally, what is man's place in the universe, man's dignity, and the meaning of life? What is man's place in the universe, man's dignity, and the meaning of life? Well, I must apologize for those of you who feel like this is a whirlwind tour. It is a whirlwind tour. I took much longer in the last course going over every bit of this so you had some feel of what it is to do philosophy, why we study it, what the major questions are, and so forth. But that at least will whet your appetite. Where did philosophy begin? It began in the Garden of Eden. And every individual and every culture subsequent to man's creation has in one way or another tried to answer these questions about the mind of man, the moral order, the public nature of truth and reason, man's place in the universe, the meaning of life. These questions have occupied everyone and every culture. If we look at, this is Roman numeral 2, in the outline from last term. If you look at ancient cultures outside of the Bible or the people of the Bible, you'll see in ancient Egypt and the Mediterranean powers around Israel, in Assyria, in Babylon, in Persia, Greece, and Rome, finally, each of these subsequent cultures had its own particular characteristics or prevailing themes. In Egypt, monophysitism dominated, the view that everything has the same nature. God, creatures, insects, crocodiles, wheat fields, man, everything has the same nature and everything is arranged hierarchically. From the most important, that'll be the pharaoh at the top, down through the priest, so forth, to the mud, and the filth of this world. Everything has one nature, arranged pyramidically. Why the Egyptians made pyramids. Okay? The Mediterranean powers, the Hittites, the Phrygians, Philistines, and so forth, you'll notice nature worship dominated, fertility cults. In Assyria and Babylon, the notion that political might makes things right, or that the stars, astrology, controls the environment. These are key cultural ideas, the spirit of the age in Assyria and Babylon, if you will. Persia was characterized by Zoroastrian dualism, the idea that there's light and darkness, good and evil, and they are ultimately equal, and they are always interacting with each other, and no one is original, and no one will finally be victorious. In Greece, you have the classical notion of fate. In Rome, the classical notion of law and order, along with the deification of the emperor. Okay, we looked at that briefly last term, just so you'd realize, although we're not looking at detailed philosophers and ideas, that there are cultural characteristics that are philosophical in nature for each of these. Roman numeral 3 brought us to the Greek poets and its history, the history of Greece. The Greek poets are of interest to us because they too look for explanations. Didn't I tell you? The main aim of a philosopher is to explain things and to justify those explanations. Well, the Greek poets like Homer and Hesiod and Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides had different ways of explaining things, but we would today consider them relatively crude explanations, mythic explanations in many cases, or anthropomorphic explanations. But nevertheless, in the Greek poets, you begin to see what eventually becomes the more philosophical approach to issues. I can only illustrate this briefly. If you begin with Homer, about 850 years before Christ, Homer does not see the moral order of the universe as being uniform or as universal. Reason cannot discover a universal order because the gods are always messing things up. Now, what's important for us is not how much did Homer believe about Greek mythology and who were these gods and what did they do. I mean, that's all entertaining. What's important for you philosophically is to see that his way of explaining things could never be reduced to a universal set of principles by which you order the world, because the gods are always arbitrary and intervening and doing things. By the time you get to Sophocles, who was born about 500 years before Christ, there is a divine law over the world that makes it well-ordered. This is not a law similar to the biblical view of providence or the biblical view of the Ten Commandments, God's holy character. But nevertheless, there is some concept in this Greek tragedian of there being a universal order, which you're really going to suffer for if you violate. In Euripides, because the higher law has been spurned, all sorts of tragedies come to Greek society, and despair is the result of it. Anyway, in the Greek poets and in their history, we begin to see the seeds of modern philosophical reflection. Roman numeral 4 brings us finally to Thales and the problem of matter, or if you will, the Milesian problem of matter. Three Milesian philosophers, Thales, Anaximander, and Anaximenes, were examined for their different views of what is the stuff that makes up the universe and everything that's in it. Is the universe made up of water? That was Thales' answer. Is it made up of air? That was Anaximenes' answer. Or is it made up of something which cannot be described with any particular characteristic, just the kind of boundless apeiron, which was Anaximander's answer? Roman numeral 5 in our study was the Pythagoreans and the wonder of order. Pythagoras was interested in math and geometry and music and found, and this really is remarkable, if you don't approach the world taking this for granted because you're a Christian, you know about God and creation and providence, it is incredible that this world has the kind of mathematical predictability and geometric order that it does. And it's workable. You can actually write songs and reproduce the song over again if you remember the proportion on the string. You can do geometry. You can build pyramids and so forth. That's pretty outrageous. Pythagoras was taken back, and he thought that had a great deal of mystical cosmic significance. Of course, it does. He secularized it and all that, but the Pythagoreans tried to explain the order of the universe. Roman numeral 6, Heraclitus and the Eleatics argue over the problem of identity and change. Heraclitus, about 500 B.C., argued that everything is changing all the time. He said you can't step in the same river twice. And therefore, the order that we think, or the identities, the continuities that we think that we see in the world, must be continuities of proportional change. That is, the reason why it appears to you that this table is not changing is because all of the changes taking place in you and in the table are simultaneous and at the same rate. And it's kind of like you're on the freeway, you know, and if you're going 63 miles an hour, 55 miles an hour, and the car right next to you is going 55 miles an hour, and if it's, you know, close enough to where it's an even pavement and both cars are nicely aligned and so forth, you can get the visual illusion that neither one of you are moving. If you don't have a background against which you see that, right? Well, if everything is moving the same rate, changing in the same fashion, Heraclitus said, then you will appear to have continuity or identity over time, but actually everything is changing. Well, Xenophanes and Parmenides and Zeno, they went the other direction. They said, no, this appearance of change in motion is what is illusory. What we know is that motion is impossible because motion is irrational. Why is motion irrational? Most every, uninitiated student of philosophy will chuckle at this. We find it silly. And so what I like to do is to put an exam question down and say, okay, refute Zeno. Zeno said, you fire an arrow, across the field. Or let's just say, we have a long enough room here. I'm going to shoot this arrow over to the other wall. Zeno said, I can prove to you that the arrow cannot ever make it to the other wall. Now you're all saying, we know it makes it to the other wall because we saw it. But notice what you did. You assumed that the way in which people know things is by looking and seeing. But another approach says, no, the way you know things is by rationally reflecting on them. Are they coherent? Are they even possible? And Zeno said, this arrow, to get to the other side of the room, must get to half the distance before it gets to the other side of the room. You all go, yeah, that's true. Well, but then before it can get to half the distance, it's got to get to half of half the distance, or a quarter, right? Yeah, okay, big deal. But if it has to get to half of the half, it has to get to half of the half of the half before it gets to the other side of the room. Yeah, okay, big deal. Well, the point is, you can half the distance infinitely. And so Zeno says, how can something which is infinite take place in a finite space or length of time? And you know what you're going to do, if you're unsophisticated, you're just going to fall back on, I saw it happen. But then again, Zeno will say, yeah, well, you have dreams where you saw things happen too, and you don't think they really happened. How do you know that the arrow going to the other side of the room is not just a dream? It's irrational. It's impossible. You can't have an infinite distance traversed in a finite amount of space. our time. So apparently that's an illusion. Okay, so that there you have Heraclitus. I know you all have a headache by now. I mean, going through the history of philosophy this quickly is bound to make you just throw up your hands and say, who knows what the nature of reality is? Who knows whether change is real? I can't figure it out. Well, the pluralists, they tried. This is Roman numeral 7. The pluralists were atomistic in their approach. They thought Parmenides was wrong to say that everything that's real makes up one solid, unchanged, what do you want to call it? Blob, I guess. The pluralists said, no, reality is made up of a bunch of little things. But they had differences among themselves. We can't get into that now. Empedocles thought that the universe was made up of four different kinds of things, earth, air, water, and fire. Anaxagoras thought that the universe is made up of an infinite number of things that are qualitatively different. So there are seeds of frogs and seeds of sailing ships and giraffes and trees and grass and all these infinite number of these different kinds of seeds made up the universe. Democritus, who gets much closer to our modern world, thought that the universe is made up of an infinite number of indivisible little things, atoms, but they were qualitatively the same, not like Anaxagoras that had them qualitatively different. And see, already 450 years before Christ, we have an anticipation of modern physics. It's pretty remarkable. The Pythagoreans and the atomists, you put them together, and that's essentially what you get taught in modern physics today. Yeah, a lot more detail, a lot more sophistication. Roman numeral 8. In ancient Greece, we find a number of philosophies of life, if you will, attitudes and ethics. We have the sophists, kind of like the lawyers of today, hired guns. The sophist said, master those techniques of debate so you can win arguments. That's all that counts. There is no truth. Everything's relative, so just get your way by good arguments. The cynics said, get back to nature. Civilization doesn't provide objective and true values. The skeptic said, no one can know for sure. The hedonist said, live for value, for pleasure, the value of pleasure. The Epicurean said, yes, live for pleasure, but make sure that it's the highest pleasures, the qualitatively superior ones, such as good conversation with friends, being rational, being moderate. The Stoics said our attitude toward life is one of recognizing we have to submit to what's going to happen. It's going to happen anyway. And to submit with a sense of duty, of it being rational to go along with the flow of the natural order. So we see a concept of natural law. And then the eclectics were the people who said, I like what this guy said a little bit and what this guy said a little bit, and they try to put it together. It's what I call the fruit salad approach to philosophy. A little bit of this, a little bit of that. Okay, we've gone through a whole bunch of philosophers, a whole bunch of philosophical issues. But you notice one philosopher says this and goes his way, another says that, goes his way. One's interested in that aspect of philosophy. Somebody else is interested in another aspect of philosophy. When we come to Roman numeral 9 in my outline, Plato, we see the beginning of systematic philosophy, the attempt to bring all this together to answer questions about the nature of reality and how we know what we know and how we should live our lives in such a way that the way you answer all those comports, the way you answer any one question comports with the way you answer other questions. There's a system there. There's an order there. And so Plato was an idealist. Plato believed that there was a reality to ideas, to forms or formulas for everything that exists. And the best of all things, and that which explains all things, is in this ideal realm beyond time and space. So I'll put it very simply to you, Plato in 10 seconds. Plato said, not only is there Huey, Dewey, and Louie, these little ducklings out on the pond, but there's also the idea of duckness, if you will, that is just as real, in fact, more real, because it's original and perfect. The idea of duck has to be counted in addition to Huey, Dewey, and Louie out on the pond. Okay, so Plato is an idealist, and he says, we know the things we know from this world by remembering the ideas, the concepts, or forms for everything. Plato's greatest student was Aristotle. Aristotle is the second great systematic philosopher. This is Roman numeral 10 in my outline. Aristotle said, Plato's ideal realm is of no value to us in explaining what's most important in our experience, and that is change. If you're going to explain the world, Plato, then you better explain how change takes place. And going outside the world to changeless ideas, concepts of triangles and ducks and all that, isn't going to cut it. And so Aristotle is a more here and now, down-to-earth philosopher. He's interested in looking at the particulars of our experience, and he had a form-matter notion that everything's made up of matter, which is potentiality, and form, which is actuality, and that things are moving from their potential to their actualization, and that's how change takes place. So for Aristotle, everything in this world is changing, developing, becoming what it's meant to be, like moving from an acorn to a tree. Everything is growing, from a tadpole to a frog, if you will. And so what you have in you is the latent form of what you will be, and matter is developing into that. For man, he's to be a rational animal. And so man doesn't grow up like a tree. Man should develop his thinking. He should be contemplative and intellectual. Nevertheless, for Aristotle, everything's explained in terms of development and purpose. He is a teleological philosopher, interested in the particulars of the world round about us, rather than an idealistic philosopher, as Plato was, trying to explain this world in terms of another world that is the original and the more important. After we looked at the two great systematic philosophers, Plato and Aristotle, we come, Roman numeral 11, to the Roman period. The Roman period. The rise of the Roman Empire, the ascendancy of three particular philosophies, Stoicism, Epicureanism, and Skepticism. But of course, the most important thing about the Roman period, and this is now Roman numeral 12, is the advent of Christ. And I took some time explaining the significance for the history of philosophy, thought, and culture that Jesus, the Messiah, now comes into history as the way, the truth, and the life for man. We begin to see the antithesis that this brings about. In your outline for our present course, you notice that in my recap and review, we have the ancient period, which we're just about ready to finish up. And then I have three words there, and I have done this, those who had the course before hopefully will remember this, but I'm trying to give you a way of looking at the whole flow of the history of philosophy. And it's one thing to get down here and look at the individual trees and analyze the bark on each one. It's another thing to get in a helicopter and get up over the forest and see what the pattern is all about. And in my estimation, the broadest pattern that you see in the history of philosophy is you have the beginning of a pagan approach to answering questions about the nature of reality, how we know what we know, and how we should live our lives. Okay, we see the Greeks, Thales, and so on, and they struggle with what's the world made of? Is motion possible? Is the world one or is it many? And are things determined or are they free? Are there values that we live for as man, just atoms falling through space? They have all these difficulties. And then you get the great philosophers, Plato and Aristotle. And they try to organize a worldview, but they don't do all that great a job. So we have paganism in its attempt to do philosophy. And what we come to now in the Roman period with the advent of Jesus Christ is the period of antithesis. The darkness has been developing, you see, in pagan history. And now the light comes into the world. And what does the darkness do? It loves the light, right? No, the Bible tells you. The darkness and the light clash. In fact, it appears, at least for a while, and according to some people still, that the darkness wins. You know, the rulers of this world, they crucify the Lord of glory. Jesus comes as the great prophet to show us the way. He comes to be the king to rule over us, the priest to atone for our sins and intercede to God. But it doesn't appear that he is the king that rules over all right now. It doesn't appear that his prophetic message is heard. And so we see at the very outset of the Christian era an antithesis between the church, or if you will, God's people, and the world. Two specific kinds of antitheses were mentioned in our previous course. One is philosophical, and a good example is seen in Acts 17, where Paul takes the gospel to ancient Athens. Athens is the intellectual center of the Western world. It's where the philosophers are, right? So you see right there in the New Testament what I'm talking about, the clash between Paul's gospel, based on the revelation of God, especially the incarnation of Christ, his death, resurrection, and the thinking of the Stoic and Epicurean philosophers that are there. So there's a philosophical antithesis or clash or conflict, but there's also in this period a political antithesis, because the church, Jesus originally is seen, and then the followers of Jesus are seen as somehow standing over against the political authority of Caesar. In Acts 17, we again see this conflict, but it's even more in Revelation chapter 13, where the beast, the Roman Empire, goes to war against the Lamb and the followers of the Lamb. Here is a symbolic or figurative way of talking about that political antithesis that was there in the original early days of the church. And so as your outline for today indicates, we have paganism and then we have antithesis. We have the development of a humanistic, man-centered, autonomous way of doing philosophy, and then we have the Son of God come into this world, the light comes into the darkness, and there's conflict, philosophical, cultural, political conflict, antithesis from that point on. Roman numeral 13 was the early Christian era, and we looked at Gnosticism and the mystery cults that were flourishing in the early days of the church, and at the Neoplatonic movement, the revival of Plato in a more mystical form in his follower Plotinus. And we looked at the Ante-Nicene Fathers, not anti-against, but ante-before Nicaea Fathers, the patristic fathers of the church, as they tried to develop a Christian way of looking at reality and how we know what we know and how we should live our lives. And the greatest of the patristic fathers was Roman numeral 14, Augustine. And I spent a great deal of time talking about the life of Augustine, his conversion, the development of his thoughts about man's nature, man's free will, the necessity of God's grace, the philosophy of history, the relationship of faith and reason, and how we should live our lives. I know that's a lot in one sentence, but we're getting late here. Augustine is, if you will, an archetypical Christian philosopher. I don't agree with everything he said, mind you, but he made a really grand beginning for bringing to expression as consistently as possible the Christian philosophy of life over against the paganism, the Manichaeanism, and